you might be getting up out of bed and thinking, where's Nikki, the gardening lady?
Nikki's show's done, folks. Maritime Morning is on the air till noon. Yeah, the Weekend Gardener wrapped up its season last week, so now we're on 9 till noon every Sunday morning. Glad to have you on board. I hope your morning is going well, even though it's gray and a bit drizzly in Halifax. There's still brightness in the day. Here's something to look forward to next weekend. You might be able to sleep in, or at least somehow feel like it. It's time to change the clocks next weekend. The first Sunday in November brings about the end of daylight saving time, not savings, so let's make sure we don't say that. Saving time when we turn the clocks back an hour, and for most people, that's great. An extra hour of sleep, perhaps. However, if you have people in your home who are on some kind of sleeping schedule or waking up early, the approach of standard time can strike fear in the hearts of even the calmest. We're talking about kids, usually. So in studio is Luann Bruno, who is an expert in this. What technically is your title?
I'm a child sleep consultant.
A child sleep consultant. So people come to you and ask you questions about, why is my baby sleep weird? How do I get my baby to sleep differently? How do I adjust? That kind of thing?
That's right, yeah. And really, it all came because I struggled with my own son's sleep habits when he was a newborn up until about he was 7 months old.
Oh, my.
And that's about the time when my husband and I said, okay, we need to really do something here. And that's when we went and hired our own sleep consultant. And after that, I said, this is great. There needs to be somebody in and around the area that does this. So that's how I got into it myself.
You found your calling through your own trouble.
Yeah. And I think nobody should have to suffer through this. There's a lot of different ways to handle things. But certainly, if your child isn't sleeping very well, it can affect you too.
Okay. Now, the time change can be disruptive even if your child is sleeping well, or even especially if your child is sleeping well. If you have a very regimented sleep schedule that works, well, then having the clocks arbitrarily changed for you can make a difference.
It's a little annoying, isn't it?
I'm wondering, is it? Because I haven't gone through this yet.
No. Well, and for people who don't have children, it does feel like you gained an extra hour, and it will be able to feel like you get to sleep in an extra hour,
yeah,
right? Because when the clocks turn back November 3rd from 2 a.m., it'll be actually 1 a.m.
Yeah, or when they change at 3, it's like 2 all over again.
There you go. So that's great. If you don't have to worry about taking anybody up and get them ready for the day, you're fine. However, if you have a little one who maybe wakes a little early, let's say 6 a.m., which is a reasonable wake-up time, that 6 a.m. is actually going to be 5 a.m. on the clock. Now, on Sunday, that might not matter to you so much because it'll feel like a regular 6 a.m., but on the Monday morning, it's still going to feel like an hour earlier.
Okay, so is this something we need to prepare for, or do we just adjust our expectations on the Sunday?
Well, there's a few things that we can do, Scott.
Sure.
So if you want to plan ahead, we can plan ahead by moving the schedule back, actually, by 15-minute increments a few days in ahead. So it would be, you know, something that parents can do. On the Thursday, they might start and put their child to bed maybe 15 minutes later. And then on the Friday, you'd put them to bed a half hour later. On the Saturday night, you put them to bed 45 minutes later than you normally would by
later.
The clock.
Okay.
Yep. So you're moving it in 15-minute increments later. So that on the Sunday, you're actually putting them to bed at the time that the clock says you normally would.
Does this mean keeping a cranky baby up for an extra 15 minutes
then
at bedtime?
And that is a little bit challenging because for some kids, they are very sensitive. When it is their time to go to bed, you want to put them to bed because if they get overtired, then you get into that super overtired baby, which is a little bit frustrating to try and settle them down to get them to go to sleep after. So
okay,
it can be
so then I bet
there.
You know about that too then.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so how do we handle that?
So this is why routines are so important. Whatever it is, your routine is it becomes so key that you do that all the time because the routine itself helps your baby expect what's coming next. All those steps follow all the time so your baby learns to associate things like your bath time, getting the sleep clothes on, reading a book, sing song with their bed place, whether it's a crib or a bed, and sleep. So the routine itself can actually trigger sleep. When it's happening at the same time every day, regularity, consistency, sleep consultants, we can't say it enough. Consistency is key.
Oh, man. Okay? You know what? You're proving my wife right up. Because just a couple days ago, I was like, I'm going to take the baby to sleep. And she says, you know, we have to do it the same way every time. I'm like, come on.
Well,
all right.
It is true.
I got to go home and eat my shorts then.
Well, That's true. And, you know, for when you have this regular routine, it's a lot easier for your child to know what to expect next, especially one that isn't verbal yet.
Right? Yes. All right.
So your options are you can plan ahead by putting them to bed a little bit later every night, a couple days leading up to daylight savings time, or you can do nothing. And now you're saying, well, now what?
Okay,
right?
Well, what does doing nothing look like?
Well, doing nothing is sort of making up for it a few days later. Because what's going to actually happen is on the Monday, they're still going to be waking up at 5 a.m. Their circadian rhythms make all of us wake up at basically the same time every day.
The baby can't even talk, let alone read a clock.
There you go. So unfortunately, your baby's probably going to wake up at 5 a.m. if they regularly wake up at 6, or hopefully you're a little bit lucky, you have one that sleeps in a little bit longer. But that's basically what's going to happen.
Sure.
Over the next few days, what I recommend you do then is just because instead of on the clock, if they normally napped at, say, 9 a.m., they'll be ready for a nap at 8, right? So you'll start putting them to bed a little bit earlier than you normally would on the clock. So instead of, you know, the 9 a.m. nap, you'd be putting them to bed at maybe 8:30 and then sorely trying to adjust that over the next few days to get them back on track for the times that it's supposed to be at.
Okay.
Okay.
So we can either adjust before or we can adjust after. It seems pretty straightforward.
Absolutely. The key to this is trying to get yourself comfortable with realizing it's nothing to get our knickers in a knot about, because unfortunately we're going to have to deal with it. But, you know, routine is really going to help us get through it.
Okay.
And the other thing that can help you get through it is using regular sunlight to help reset the biological clock for your son or your daughter.
Now, we've heard about this in grown-ups for years, that exposure to bright light, hopefully daylight, hopefully we get sunlight, is the natural thing to program us.
Absolutely.
So during the day, get the child in front of a window or what?
Expose them to light.
Okay.
Yeah. So if hopefully we have some nice weather over the week following daylight savings time. We have had some great weather here. But definitely try and get out, expose your child to light to help reset that clock. And why it's important too is because light is involved in melatonin production, which we need to feel sleepy, right? So once you're done being out in the sun, that when you come back into a darker environment, as you're getting through closer to your nap time routine or your bedtime routine, into that darker environment, you start priming the body for melatonin production and getting into that sleepy feeling. And then with your routine involved, all those triggers work together to help prepare your child for sleep.
If we are, okay, now you're talking about delaying the time in advance. Is there any point in all this that we should be putting a child into a dark room earlier
Absolutely.
Or later?
Well, dark rooms, when it comes to your sleep environment for your child, it's important to make sure that there isn't light in the room because it does inhibit melatonin production. So you want to make sure that there isn't light coming into the room during a daytime nap. Uh-huh. So I totally recommend blackout shades, anything you can do to keep it dark, right? And definitely make sure it's a darker environment when you want your child to sleep. So think cave when you're thinking nap time
and bedtime.
Take the
baby into the cave. Okay. All of these things I suppose we could apply to ourselves. If you're the type of person whose sleep pattern gets disrupted. I mean, there are some people who go to bed at a strict specific time and get up at a strict specific time. If you're the type of person who feels wrecked when your schedule's disrupted, I suppose you could do the same tricks, delay your bedtime a bit each day this week?
Yeah, absolutely you can. Now, the thing is, again, with the way that the environment's going to change a little bit with the day, you know, this day's getting a little bit shorter. When you do expose yourself to daylight while you're up and doing your regular daily routines, eventually you're going to adjust to it anyway. So it may take a few days. Some people are a little bit more sensitive to it than others, but it will take a couple days and eventually you'll be able to adjust.
You may feel jet lagged.
You
a
may
little
a
bit.
Little bit, yeah.
And if your child is waking up earlier than you'd like, should you rush in and do something?
Absolutely not. Okay, and this is where it gets a little bit controversial because people say, oh, you shouldn't let your baby cry. And definitely when it comes to anything like sleep training, that's something that, you know, you want to be sure you're not going to be doing sleep training until it's actually age appropriate for your child. Mm. And what that means is you want to be sure that your child is on the right growth curve, they're gaining weight appropriately. So you really should be making sure with your family doc that it's appropriate to cease night feeding if that's something you were going to do and that it's safe to do sleep training. And there's no medical reason that you might not. For example, if your child has a sleep apnea or if your child's sick, right? We don't do that kind of thing if your child's sick. But basically, you want to make sure that you do have a routine all the time and you follow that routine. Mm. And when you have these things, everything's going to fall into place properly.
All right. I feel well prepared now.
Okay.
So adjust the bedtime, dark room, routine.
Absolutely.
I follow. Thank you very much for this. This has been, I've been looking forward all week to hearing about this because it's out of my realm of expertise.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Scott.
How can people find you? You said you had a Facebook page.
There's actually a website. It's www.babysleepright.com.
Babysleepright.com. Luann, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Luann Bruneau is a sleep consultant. So before you go to bed or back to bed for a nap, we have more things to consider, and among them is a health matter. Canada's falling behind in tackling hepatitis C, according to some international experts who are calling for government action. We'll talk to the chair of the Canadian Liver Foundation next on Maritime Morning. Hundreds of thousands of Canadians have hepatitis C. Only a fraction have ever undergone treatment for the potentially fatal liver disease. International researchers and experts came together in Toronto for Hepatitis C Virus From Discovery to Cure, a big symposium presented by the Gairdner Foundation. I've never heard of them. And the Canadian Liver Foundation to present a compelling case for government action on hepatitis C. A man who knows exactly how to pronounce that word is Dr. Maurice Sherman, chair of the Canadian Liver Foundation. Did I blow the pronunciation of the foundation there?
Gairdner, correct? Yeah, Gairdner's correct.
All right. Dr. Sherman, thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome.
What is the government not doing?
Well, that's a kind of an overarching question. The question is, what should the government be doing?
That they're not doing?
Yeah. Well, I think that hepatitis C is an unprecedented problem in the healthcare field. We have hundreds of thousands of people infected by this virus who are at risk of developing bad liver disease over the next 10 to 20 to 30 years. We don't have anywhere near the facilities required to deal with this. And really what it needs is a programmatic approach from all levels of government, federal and provincial, to find those patients who have hepatitis C, to get them into treatment, and for those for whom treatment is unsuccessful or whose disease is too far advanced, to provide the appropriate care that they need to ensure that they have the best quality of life.
It really is
a big program that needs to be done, and this just doesn't exist.
That's a huge challenge. I mean, where did 300,000 people get hepatitis C, something that, as by my understanding, was only identified a few decades ago?
Correct. Hepatitis C was identified a few decades ago, but it's been in existence for many, many years before that. So there are really two sort of major groups of people who have chronic hepatitis C. You know, it used to be that it was the transfusion-related disease, but that is really only a minor contributor at the moment. The major contributors are those people who have ever used injection drugs, and we're thinking not specifically of those who are actively using, but people who, for example, in the 60s and 70s were part of the hippie generation and who used casually, never became addicted, and then stopped using and went on to be otherwise responsible citizens. There's a fairly large group of those individuals, and the other large group is the immigrant population, because we get a lot of immigrants from parts of the world where hepatitis C is very common. And in those parts of the world, it's spread by contaminated medical procedures, inadequately sterilized needles and syringes, some ritual tribal practices, and so on. So there are a number of different routes that people can acquire the disease, but you know they bring it to Canada when they come here.
Is this 300,000 number based on people who've been tested and found to have it, or is this some kind of extrapolated estimate based on?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I mean, the Health Canada has records of about 250,000, 260,000 people. What we don't know is what the number of untested people are who have hepatitis C. Estimates in other countries would suggest that fewer than 50% know they have the disease. And if that's true in Canada, then we're looking at a number much larger than 300,000. So 300,000 is a bit of an extrapolation, but we really don't know how many people there are in Canada with hepatitis C.
Wow. And even if it's, you know, I hate to say only 300,000, that's an awful lot. So a lot of these people may know they have it. Should they be treated in a way that they haven't been?
Yeah. Well, not everybody with hepatitis C needs treatment, and even if they do need treatment, they may not need it right away. I mean, you can imagine that it's not going to be possible to treat 300,000 people all at once. So there has to be some sort of triage for those who need the treatment most urgently, and that's those whose liver disease is most advanced. Because when we treat with successfully, it's a cure. Patients do not develop any further progression of their liver disease. So if we can catch it before they start developing liver failure, then there's a very good chance that they'll never have any problems with their liver in their lives. So we have to sort of prioritize it to be able to treat those who need it most, treat them first. But you know, ultimately, everybody is going to need to be treated.
Because everybody with hepatitis C eventually has problems?
Well, the opinions differ on that. Some people say that if you live long enough, you will develop problems with your hepatitis C, but sometimes you might need to live to be 120 before you run into trouble.
Ah.
But what we're seeing is that the older you are, the higher the chances are of getting into trouble with hepatitis C. So sometimes we see people in their 80s and 90s, and you know, we really can't do very much for them because of the toxicity of our current treatment. So ideally, you want to catch people when they're younger, when they can still tolerate the treatment, although, having said that, we have much better tolerated treatment coming in the near future.
Oh, good. Well, yeah, that's good news. And is it going to be economical enough that the government might look at it and say, all right, we have a well-tolerated treatment, it's affordable, let's roll it out big time?
Yeah, I don't think affordable is going to fit in the picture.
Oh, okay.
These are going to be hugely expensive drugs. And so that's part of the problem. I mean, I don't think any government can afford to pay for treatment for all the patients, or at least not over a short period of time. And so that's another reason why it has to be spaced out, because otherwise, you know, it's going to cost billions of dollars. But if you spread it out over 10 to 15 to 20 years, it's not as bad as if you have to do it over 2 to 3 years.
Well, you have all the big names in the liver care, I don't want to say in a cynical way, industry, but the liver care sector asking the government to do something about this. Has the government answered back yet?
Well, I'm not entirely sure what's happening at the provincial level. I have had some discussions with the provincial epidemiologist, and I have been told that they are working on it, but I haven't yet seen anything come out of that. At the federal level, there was a meeting a couple of weeks ago to try and put together some idea of how many people there are in Canada with hepatitis C so that we can figure out whether we need to be screening the population at large for hepatitis C. But as far as I know, that's about the extent of it. The federal government also does provide, I think it's something in the range of $10 million a year for support programs for hepatitis C. But if you compare that with HIV, it's a drop in the bucket. HIV gets from the, I think they get about 47, 50 million, something in that range. There are about at least five times as many people with hepatitis C as HIV, and the death rate from hepatitis C annually exceeds that of HIV.
Mm.
So it really requires some redistribution of resources.
Well, that's, man, a big issue, big thing to consider. If there's anybody listening, to take this from a macro to a micro level, if there's anybody listening who knows they have hepatitis C and this has spurred them to action, Is there something personally people can do on a patient-by-patient basis to drive this forward?
You know, I think this is going to require some sort of political move. So anything that puts pressure on governments because the population demand it is likely to help the overall situation. So, I mean, I'm not sure what the best kind of approach might be, but to let their voices be known that they have hepatitis C and that treatment is available and we want it.
Good. Doctor, thanks very much for sharing this all with us.
You're welcome.
All the best to you, sir.
Bye.
That's Dr. Morris Sherman. He's the chair of the Canadian Liver Foundation. We're going to take a Halloween-y bent next after the news. We'll talk about horror movies. What makes a great horror movie? What do the really good ones have in common? And then I want to know your favorite scary movies, your favorite horror movies, whether they're good ones, whether they're bad ones. Yesterday we started the show with Halifax Police Constable Don Jenkins. And apparently he's a big B-movie fan. I didn't know this. He likes the bad movies. He likes the horror movies that are just terrible. So whether it's a good one, whether it's a bad one, I want to know your favorite scary movies. We'll ask you after a chat with a horror film expert, coming right up after the news on Maritime Morning. It's 11:33 on Maritime Morning. You can find us here on the radio on News 95.7 Halifax, News 88.9 St. John, News 91.9 in Moncton, every Saturday from 8 till noon, Sundays from 9 till noon. If you're expecting to hear gardening advice right now, you'll have to tune in next spring. Nikki Jabor with The Weekend Gardener celebrated her last episode of the season last weekend after a great season, great gardening season. That was a decent summer, yeah? Yeah, it's a decent fall so far, except it's gray and rainy in Halifax today. So if you're hoping to go out and rake some leaves, you're going to get a little wet. Trying something new this year. Trying a mulching lawnmower to just run over the leaves and turn them into dust. And from what I can see, it's looking pretty good. Thanks to my father-in-law for going out there and doing it. He looks like he has fun doing that. We're looking to talk this hour, or this half hour, about horror movies. Halloween, of course, is just around the corner. So Netflix and the world's largest and most well-known horror publication, Rue Morgue Magazine, have teamed up to help stream and scream with a list of the funniest, weirdest, and most horrifying horror movies and television on Netflix. And the list is curated by Dave Alexander. He's a horror expert and editor-in-chief at Rue Morgue Magazine. The only problem is we're having a hard time answering him. Maybe he's out on a zombie walk right now. Can't quite find Dave. Dave Alexander, horror expert and editor-in-chief at Rue Morgue Magazine. So in the meantime, I'll turn it over to you. 405-6000 with your favorite horror movie or horror TV show. I know that FX Canada is showing the American Horror Story Coven series right now. And from what I hear, from those who've watched it, it's a good show. Scary, too. 1-877-801-8255. That's 405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. I've never been much of a scary movie fan, although I can remember growing up going to sleepovers and watching shows like movies like Poltergeist. And, well, Poltergeist is the only one that comes to mind. We watched a few of them, and they were entertaining for what they were, but I was really there for the tacos and the pizza and the things at the sleepover. Scary movies just haven't really done it for me. I remember seeing The Blair Witch Project, and the claim to fame at the time of The Blair Witch Project was in theaters anyway, is that it would make you sick. But what made you sick was not so much the action, the story, the suspense. It was the camera work. It was shot on video and then blown up to big screen size. And seeing like low resolution handycam video blown up to screen size was just gross. I didn't throw up, but I don't think anybody really tried that since, have they? So looking for your calls on the best horror movies or you know, not necessarily the best done, but your favorite based on your enjoyment of it strictly. 405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Hey, Barry.
Hi. It was funny. Well, years ago, my late wife and I took our 13-year-old sister-in-law to there was still a drive-in movie, The Exorcist.
Yes.
To a 13-year-old girl. We brought her home. I mean, it was like, her mother was wild, but it was 2 days. She couldn't go to sleep. She was terrified every time she closed her eyes. We never even realized that it would have that effect on someone that young.
Had you all seen it before taking her?
I had, no. It was, usually those movies don't scare me. It was, for its time, it was amazing. You know, it was way over what we're normally used to. It was incredible. I mean, you've seen The Exorcist, haven't you?
I have not seen The Exorcist. I've seen clips of it, but I've never seen the full movie.
I mean, we see so much now that it doesn't have that effect to us anymore with computer-generated stuff. But back then, there wasn't really all, Yeah, you look at the old ones, they look funny, but that one, by that standard, really was scary, and it had a good storyline, you know.
Did it, so it stuck with you through the years. What do you remember of it?
Well, possession. I mean, the child's floating off the bed, vomiting on the priestess. Rather gross and disgusting, actually, but it did have an effect on you. And if you were a Catholic boy that was told about possessions, you know, and all that foolishness, yeah, it sort of freaked you out a little bit.
I could imagine if your belief system included, you know, the sense that this could happen or that this does happen, then to see it up there in action on the screen would really touch you.
Yeah, well, the world was more naive years ago than they are today. Unfortunately, you know, the age of innocence is gone. But, yeah, to go to that level back then, it was incredible. And the effect, I mean, that most people that we talked to after that scene too were really freaked out by it. Today, I mean, nothing freaks you out because you've seen just about everything, eh?
True enough. Well, yeah, with
everything. Yeah, we're numb to it now, and it doesn't, you know, they're none of them. You know, most of these things, you know what's going to happen halfway through them anyway, unfortunately, by being through it so many times.
Sure. Barry, when's the last time you saw The Exorcist?
Actually, a little while ago, I watched it on Netflix, just out of curiosity, and like I said, it looks pretty drab, but you know, but it was freaky. I mean, it was at the time.
Interesting. All right, Barry, thanks for sharing that. That's a good discussion starter right there. I appreciate Barry calling in with that. Is The Exorcist on this guy's list? I don't want to spoil the list in case we are able to find Dave Alexander. See, Dave Alexander knows how to send a scare into my veins. He knows how to chill and thrill me. By not answering the phone on a Sunday morning. We were having a perfect show so far as finding guests. Last weekend was a little rough on a Sunday. A few scares, but this is the first one. So, no, I don't see The Exorcist. I will write on The Exorcist. I'm trying to see if I've seen any of these. Blair Witch Project, definitely saw that. Young Frankenstein? I thought Young Frankenstein was a comedy. Frankenstein, I believe it's pronounced, is it not? Anyway, so what's your favorite horror movie? Is that Dave? We have Dave? Let's get Dave hooked up. Is that Dave? Dave's a winner. Hey, Dave, good morning.
Hey, how you doing? Good morning.
Where did we wake you up?
No, not at all. I just missed your call. I was in the other room, and I was trying to call back, and I kept going to this Rogers mailbox number. I couldn't get a human being.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Well, speaking of things that aren't quite human, you have curated this big list for Netflix and your magazine. How do I properly pronounce your magazine?
Rue Morgue.
Oh, that's what I thought.
Murders in the Rue Morgue from the Post story.
Oh, okay. Well, that's pretty cool. So you like these horror movies. You love them.
Oh, yeah.
What are the common elements that string the good ones together?
Well, the thing of the horror genre is it's so wide and vast that when I was picking a list, I was kind of going for a little something for everyone. There's some classics. There's some TV stuff. There's some newer stuff, some stuff that's a little harder-edged. Stuff's a little more family-friendly. But I guess one thing that you can maybe say connects any good horror movie is that it gives you a response. You know, maybe it makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. It gives you a little chill. It gives you a good laugh even. But you get some sort of physical response from the good ones.
Well, that is a good point. Now, do you find yourself leaning toward the older ones or more modern ones?
I'm really all over the map. I guess when you're as far down the horror rabbit hole as I am.
Yeah.
Kind of like everything. But I have to say, the stuff that they put out in the 70s was really fantastic. I wanted to make sure I had Legend of Hell House on that list there. I think it's a great example of some of the horror films that came out in the 70s where, you know, they're making things happen with practical effects, and nowadays everyone's using CG because it's a lot cheaper and quicker. But you know, it's just not quite the same. You know, I like seeing when they've actually had to rig tables to move around the room and stuff flying at the actors.
Sure.
I think it just anchors you a little bit more in the movie and gets you a little more scared.
Actual liquids flying around.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1973 British horror film directed by John
Howe.
Howe, starring Pamela Franklin, Roddy McDowall, Clive Revel, and Gail Honeycutt. Screenplay by Richard Matheson. The poster itself looks creepy.
Yeah, well, the other thing, too, is we lost Richard Matheson this year in June. He passed away, and, of course, he was responsible for I Am Legend, which also was the main influencer on George Romero's Night of Living Dead, which, of course, started this whole zombie thing. So Matheson is a very influential guy in the genre, and I also felt it was important to celebrate him a little bit by having one of his titles on the list.
Mm, interesting. So what makes The Legend of Hell House so compelling other than the practical effects? I mean, is it a story that draws you in?
Yeah, the story's interesting, and it's really disturbing. So you've got this group of people that go to this infamous haunted house that was once owned by this millionaire Lothario guy who was into some really evil, decadent stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that made, like, Caligula look like Mr. Rogers. And so there's this evil backstory and this presence in the house. And so they bring in all this technical equipment. And so it's sort of a forerunner to, any of these movies like Insidious, which is also on the list, where they have these kind of Ghostbuster characters or paranormal investigators. And so they bring in here and they want to kind of get to the bottom of the mystery and why this evil spirit's in the house, and it starts to mess with them and turn them on each other. And there's a level of paranoia, and there's just some crazy stuff happens. I don't want to give a lot away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, no spoilers. Okay, so is this widely available, this Legend of Hell House?
It's around. Definitely the easiest way to watch it is on Netflix.
Oh, good.
It's been released over the years, but it's one that's, it's a little off radar.
Well, if Netflix has it, then it's pretty accessible. What else? What do you think? What's the most recent one on your big list here?
One of the most recent ones, actually, on that.
I see Walking Dead's on your list.
Yeah, well, it's ongoing, and it's just I still love it. You know, a lot of horror fans are getting tired of zombies, but I still think the TV show is really strong. It's very strongly written. The characters are fantastic. It still can shock and appall you with some of the violence and the gore gags, and it really anchors you in the story as well. It's just good storytelling. But in terms of movies, I've also put one on there that's a great little sort of a gem waiting to be discovered called Would You Rather?
Mm. What's that on?
Yeah. Well, it's the concept is sort of, it's the game Would You Rather that people play. Where you sort of ask someone, would you rather fight a shark or a bear? That kind of thing.
Yes.
But what this is, there's a bunch of people gathered for a dinner party, and they don't exactly know what's going on. But this rich guy has gathered them, and he plays a really wicked game of Would You Rather. They can't leave. And they're seated around the table, and they start doing nasty things to each other to survive, and he sort of plays upon their greed. But there's a great Canadian connection because Rob Wells from the Trailer Park Boys is in it.
Oh.
Playing, yeah, and he plays a completely different character. It's really fantastic to see him in this other role. There's also like porn star Sasha Gray is in it, and Jeffrey Combs stars as the evil rich guy, and everyone knows him from Reanimator. So you've got this really interesting cast that comes together, and it's just like a fun little wicked movie that is a great one to discover on Netflix because it's one you may not see it, on the shelves at your local store.
Well, if the poster on Netflix looks anything like the poster I'm seeing on IMDb right now, it will catch your attention. I can't even look at it. It's somebody holding a razor blade up to an eyeball. That's creepy.
Classic image. It goes right back to the 20s, El Chien Andalou.
Oh, of course.
The famous short film, and the Pixies have mentioned that movie back in the day. And, anything. You put that shirt to someone's eye and it just freaks you right out.
Yeah, I remember they showed it when I was in radio and TV school in film class. They showed us that that famous scene from El Chien Andalou with the cutting open of the eyeball, and it was just some image that stays with you your whole life.
Oh, I don't. And that's one of the great things about horror genre, is there's nothing that affects us. Fear is the biggest motivator to human beings. And so to have a genre centered around fear, you know, nothing is as memorable, nothing will get under your skin like the horror genre. Things that compels me.
I do need to ask you about Blair Witch Project. I remember seeing it when it was in theaters, and I just didn't get it. It just went flat with me. Is it just me, or is there something I'm missing about why that's such a great movie?
The thing with the Blair Witch Project is it's a total love-hate thing. People feel so strongly about this film, whether they love it or hate it.
Uh-huh.
A lot of it has to do with the way it's presented. A lot of people can't watch found footage movies. It makes them nauseous, or they can't buy into the world of it. It just takes them right out, or they think it looks too cheap. Whereas other people feel that it's more real, and they're actually in the documentary, and they forget they're watching the movie a little easier. So that's part of it. And then the other part of that movie is, and this speaks to the subjective nature of horror, of what really gets under your skin. So like a film, say The Exorcist, for example, if you're Catholic, that film will probably affect you a lot more because of your background. With The Blair Witch, if you've sort of ever gone camping in the fall or been lost in the woods, it'll affect you a lot more. And I remember growing up in Alberta and going camping in the fall and just feeling that cold, spooky, leafless forest kind of feels like it's closing in on you, and so that already is kind of scary. And then for me, I love theater of the mind, where they're taking you to a place, and they're letting your mind do the rest of the work. So if they would have actually showed us a witch, it wouldn't have been as effective for me, because whatever I'm thinking it looks like in my head is going to be worse than whatever special effect they're going to show. So for me, that works, but not for everybody. They just some people, it just takes them right out, and they have a real expectation that they need to have a payoff of like a monster. So it's a really subjective thing. It doesn't mean, you don't get horror movies because you don't like it. It's just one of those ones. But for me, it really got me. I saw it 3 times in the theater, so I had to put it on the list.
You know, I think the way you've described it there, I would give it another chance. I'd watch it on TV. I think seeing it in the theater was what put me off, because it was just that look of video blown up on the big screen was just a little too much for me.
Well, it's really good that you mentioned that too, because a lot of times you go to the theater and there's people there that don't want to give themselves over to a movie, so they're, maybe they're laughing or people are getting up. So I find for some of the stuff, if it's a serious movie, you kind of want to watch it in the dark by yourself at home and just let it take you to that place. And that's what I did the first time I saw it in the theater. And I saw it again, and I remember there was somebody smoking in the theater, and I was like, what the hell is going on here? And it just was a totally different experience. I actually wasn't into it that time.
All right, Dave.
Your point is very valid.
All right, Dave, I got to wrap it up. Thanks very much for spending some time with us this morning.
No problem, man. I really appreciate it. And I hope everyone out there and all your listeners have a fantastic Halloween.
And we'll invite them to check out Rue Morgue Magazine.
We are 100% Canadian.
Check it out. Thanks, Dave. That's Dave. Right. He's the editor-in-chief at Rue Morgue Magazine. All right, well, we'll throw it back to you. If you have your favorite horror movie ever, or you want to play Would You Rather, I thought that would be fun. We have a couple minutes left, and one of Dave's favorite movies is a horror movie called Would You Rather. We'll play a couple rounds of Would You Rather. Give us a call at 405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255 to take us to the end of this day's Maritime Morning. I've had a lot of fun this weekend. I think we covered a lot of informative ground and some entertaining stuff, too. Thanks for joining us this weekend on Maritime Morning. News 95.7 in Halifax, News 88.9 in Moncton, News 91... News 88.9 in St. John, News 91.9 in Moncton. Throw a .com on the end of any of those, and you'll find us online where you can download this week's podcasts and listen to it all over again if you missed any part of it. Hey, Jen, you want to play a couple of rounds of Would You Rather? Yeah, just throw on those headphones. We were talking about talking with Dave about Would You Rather the movie, and he's mentioned it's a game that people play. I just thought I'd throw a couple rounds at you. Jen?
Sure.
Would you rather, as a leader, would you rather be loved or be feared?
Ooh, I'd rather be loved.
Yeah, I think so, too. Let's see what else we have here. Would you rather... This website needs to refresh itself faster. Would you rather? I see. I don't even get this one. I don't remember my school enough. Would you rather be a Montague or a Capulet?
Ooh, I guess I'll say a Capulet. Just because.
What does that even mean?
I don't even know.
Those are characters. That's from
Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, but I don't get it. Would you rather be telekinetic or telepathic?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Like a mind reader, I guess, or be able to move things with your mind?
Oh, man. You know what? I think I'd rather move things with my mind because I'd be afraid of what other people were thinking.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So if you've ever spent time in your own mind, yeah, you know that other people's minds are probably a pretty scary place to be. Yeah, I'd rather move things with my mind. I mean, I'd frankly prefer to be even half decent at reading people's faces and being able to accept social cues. But being a mind reader versus being able to move stuff with your mind. Yeah, move stuff with my mind.
Scott, would you rather be rich or happy?
Oh, I'd rather be happy with what I have than have the money to try to outspend my sadness.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Would you rather be rich or famous?
Oh, probably rich. Then if I was rich, then I wouldn't have to necessarily have worry about people following me around. You know what I mean?
Like, exactly.
Just watching what people go through. Famous
people. Oh, they just seem so miserable. Rich people. Yeah. You know, they say money can't buy happiness. They haven't given me the chance to try. I'll give it a shot. Thanks, Jen, for playing.
No problem.
Let's look at a few more of the movies on the Netflix and Rue Morgue magazine list. The Loved Ones, don't recall it. Pan's Labyrinth, that wasn't that old. Session 9, haven't heard of it. The Omen, that's a classic with the Devil Boy. Legend of Hell House, we mentioned that one. Would You Rather? Event Horizon isn't that old. The Reef, Insidious, Pumpkinhead. I don't know if that was a low-budget one. Child's Play with the scary doll, Chucky. That had several... The creepy doll freaks you out? Really?
It's so creepy looking.
All right. And The Fly, of course. I don't know if that's the original or the remake with... what's his name? The guy who was in Jurassic Park. Goldblum. Jeff Goldblum. Yeah. All right, this has been a fun day. Thanks to everybody who's been a part of it. You can keep following us on Twitter at MMWeekend. I'm at Simpson957. If you have show ideas, go ahead and send them on to our email address. Mine is scott.simpson@rci.rogers.com. Big thanks to Jen McNeil, producer, for throwing together some, and I don't want to say throwing together because she lovingly crafted a couple of great shows over the past few weeks. Months. I'm just looking for my end quote, and I had a little file here that had all my goodbye quotes in it, and they upgraded all the computer systems last week, and I don't have them anymore. So I'll leave you with this thought. When you back up your computer, back up your computer. Just do it.